Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 15 of the Footmarks podcast. I'm your host, Behram Kazi. You can find me at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me is Jared Kimber, and we're going to talk about his elaborate series that he penned down called In the Shadow of Shane Warne in this podcast. And don't be mistaken, we're not going to be actually talking about Warney in this podcast, but all the other spinners in and around Shane Warne. So just to start off, Jared, what was your inspiration behind writing down this 37-minute read?
I think there was a few different things. One was I was a leg spinner and I grew up under Shane Warne. And I've written about that before and you know, talked about that on the podcast and everything before. But, you know, I started bowling leg spin before Shane Warne did. And it was not before he did, but before he became famous. And then the difference in my life of cricket after when everyone was bowling leg spin and every batter would come in and rip the ball sideways and no one really was bowling very good leg spin. So I was always interested in the impact that Warne had on other people. And then around 10, 11, it just got crazy around that period. You know, that was, I think Bryce McGain had finished. Jason Crazier had just come through. They'd been using batters as bowlers. And then you had the Xavier Doherty, Michael Beer, Nathan Horatzing all happen within the space of 15 minutes. And I was like, there's a book in this. I really want to write a book about all the other players. I remember I talked to Brad Hogg and he was shocked. He was like, it's not a book. In fact, Hoggy wouldn't even remember this, but it was the first time we ever chatted was about this. He goes, what? That's a terrible idea for a book. And I was like, I don't think it is, mate. And the reason was, and I knew it wasn't because Dan Bredig also wanted to write the book. And so I remember us discussing it a little bit and thinking about it. I don't know if Bredig ever tried to get it up. I tried to get it up again recently. And I got interest from publishers, but not enough interest that I was going to jump on it. But it was just in my brain of this thing of, these are really interesting people. This is not just a normal story. And it's a bit like when I did the New Zealand opening batters. I remember when I first looked at the New Zealand opening batters, I remember George Nobel was next to me and I was going to write an article for Crick Info. And he's like, this is the most boring article you've ever written. Don't write this. And he was right at that time. But when you actually go away from New Zealand are not very good at opening batting, and you start to look at why and how and the stories of the poor people who've had to do it, you start to go, oh, wow, this is, there's actually a haunted style of cricketer here. And I thought that Shane Warne shadow was the next one, right? You could do the new Bothams would be another really, really fascinating one from England as well. There are some players or some situations that just mean that you are haunted. And, you know, the South African spinners is another great one that I will get to one day. Of just these people who are just, like, they're doing the wrong thing in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's not their fault, right? And they come at it from these different angles, and that's why you end up with these fascinating stories.
Yeah, I wonder what the South African spinners title would be, In the Shadow of
Patson Cox. No shadow. There is no shadow.
In the no shadow of Patson Cox. But anyway, you took a fair few names of post-Warne spinners, but I want to rewind the clock a bit. Prior to Shane Warne and post-Richie Beno, Australian cricket didn't have a spinner with the superstar tag, right? You did have players like Bruce Yardley, who, weirdly enough, was a fast bowler and then became a spinner. And then you also had Ashley Mallett. But, you know, even though these guys were successful, they chalked out successful careers, they weren't big enough to, you know, be prominent in the history books. Let's just say that. So why do you think that is?
The important thing is that Australia had great spinners up until Richie Benaud, right? And part of that was that Australia also had uncovered wickets. And uncovered wickets obviously, you know, develop in a slightly different way. And I do think that as covered wickets come into Australia, that you do, and also we go to six, probably when they also went to six ball overs, because obviously Australia had eight ball overs for a while, which helps spinners. I think there's just a couple of different things that happened. But Clara Grimmett, obviously the first bowler to take 200 wickets in Test cricket. Bill O'Reilly was his partner, was even better. Chuck Fleetwood-Smith, Bill O'Reilly said he was better than both of them, but we never saw the best of him because of World War II. Plus, Chuck Fleetwood-Smith was, you know, an interesting character, let's say. And so he didn't quite get the most. He didn't take cricket as seriously as perhaps some other cricketers of his era did. Even in an amateur era, he stood out for not taking it particularly seriously. But the point is that they had three incredible spinners. And then after World War II, you know, they end up with Richie Benaud again, who I think Richie doesn't have a great average when you look at it overall, but because he was in the side slightly earlier because he was an all-rounder. But I think it's the back half of his career where he was absolutely fantastic. So they have all these spinners coming through. Conditions changed a little bit. And I think when the conditions changed, it didn't really help spin bowling as much at that point. And so because you have Tomo and because you have Lilly, and even because you have Rodney Hogg and Len Pascoe and then eventually Merv Hughes and Craig McDermott, Bruce Reid. There's a lot of bowling talent there. Some at all-time great level, some at Australian great level, and some at just really good quality test match level. You know, even some, you throw in someone like Mike Whitney, you know, who played some really good test matches for Australia. And you go back and you look at the spinners, they were holding bowlers, right? They were unsexy kind of bowlers. And Australia traditionally hasn't been a good place for off spin to be bowled. It is a better place for wrist spin to be bowled. And there's a basic reason for that, Bayron, which is simply that when you bowl wrist spin, right, you put overspin on every ball, and so you get a little bit of extra bounce. And when you bowl finger spin, generally put more side spin on the ball. And that is why off spinners don't have as much success. But also, when you have a successful off spinner in Australia, like Mallett or, you know, like Yardley and those sorts of guys, when they go overseas, bowling with overspin doesn't help them anymore. That's why Nathan Lyon has sometimes struggled in Asia compared to how talented he looks in. Like, Nathan Lyon sometimes can look as good in other countries as he does in Asia. And it's partly just because of this thing. And so a lot of Australian finger spinners don't spin the ball a lot, right? Because they're trying not to spin the ball more because they're trying to get more overspin on the delivery. And so if you look at Ashley Mallett, he just looks like a boring club spinner, right? And I think Yardley was a little bit different because he bowled faster. But again, if you watch Yardley bowl, like the only finger spinner before Warne that looks sexy, really, is probably Tim May. You know, if you look at Tim May, you're just like, oh, this is an action. But the others didn't have that. And I think that there was this idea in Australia that if you threw the ball to someone like Bruce Yardley and just told him to bowl spin, he'd be as good as someone who bowled it full time, right? And there was that huge thinking. And then Alan Border takes a 12-wicket haul and all these sorts of things keep happening.
11-wicket haul.
All these things keep happening where they just...
Which is 11 out of his 39 wickets in Test cricket, and they came versus the West Indies, which was the best team of the time, which is as bizarre a stat as I've ever
seen. You know, you have Mark Waugh come through as well, right? So you have these guys who can do it. And, you know, Mark Waugh doesn't even believe in off-spin. Mark Waugh came to off-spin after being a seamer, right? Again. Andrew Simons was another one. So in Australia, you kind of think Darren Lehman ends up bowling, what, five or six overs a game in one-day cricket, right? They think that they can just throw the ball to anyone and they'll be roughly as good as a frontline spinner. And there's truth to that, but there's also, obviously, it doesn't actually make sense when you drill down on it. But a lot of it is conditions-based. But the fact that they didn't have a wrist spinner who was great in that period is probably just dumb luck, right? Because they'd had so many throughout their history to suddenly get to a point where they didn't have any. That was the thing. But in Australian cricket, a wrist spinner is thought of as a proper bowler and a finger spinner is thought of, to quote Gideon Haigh, as cricket's rubbish skill. That is how we think of finger spin, specifically off spin in Australia.
Yeah, no, we'll definitely come to that later on. But I want to focus right now on the spinners that were there during Warne's time. And the first name that comes to my mind before even reading your piece, right, was Stuart McGill. Because this is a guy who was very similar to Warne, but as you describe in your piece, just different enough. And you know, use the analogy, you know, of being similar to the whole Akshar Patel and Ravindra Jadeja situation. And look, this is a guy who took 208 wickets at 29 apiece. His initials read SCG. He even moved to Sydney from Perth. And, you know, bowling in tandem with Warne, you know, on spinning wickets. He was a really, really successful spinner. And, you know, if you look at bowlers since Warne, or spinners, Australian spinners since Warne, you know, it's Shane Warne, Nathan Lyon, and then Stuart McGill at 208 wickets. So that's quite fantastic since 1992, of course. And, you know, the interesting thing is that when Warne retired, you thought you had a like-for-like replacement, carbon copy, all of that stuff. But he plays four tests, also largely because of dodgy knee. But he averages 65 in those, and then he retires. So would you say that, you know, Shane Warne being there contributed to Stuart McGill's success?
Yeah, I think that there's no way to look at his record. Essentially, what was happening with McGill was he was only playing when the pitches were ragging sideways. And at the other end, you know, if you're a spinner and you played with Murali or you've played with Warne, you basically had the biggest advantage ever because the guy at the other end is not only attacking and put everyone under pressure, but he's not going for any runs, right? And so you match that up with yourself at the other end on a spinning wicket. And I think that McGill's overall record is flattering because of that. Doesn't mean I don't think he was a fantastic bowler, because, you know, he's a better leg spinner than the West Indies have ever had. He's a better leg spinner than New Zealand or South Africa or England have ever had, right? He's still of that quality. He's in the conversation of the top, I don't know, 20 or 25 best leg spinners of all time. But I do think his actual record, when you look at it, is really, really flattered by Shane Warne. But I think by the end of his career, look, I didn't go too much into it in the piece. I mentioned it very briefly that, you know, he's had issues off the field since. And I think those were certainly starting to come out towards the end of his career. He wanted to be famous on TV. You know, he wanted a different kind of career. He's not a very natural host. And I think that, you know, he wanted his own show about wine. You know, that was his big thing, right? Or he wanted his own travel show. I'm not sure he's really a natural host in that way. So that didn't go particularly the way he wanted. Obviously, his wife at that stage was also a TV host. And he had one eye on that career, and his body was falling apart, right? He, you know, you look at him compared to Warne, he was never the kind of athlete that Warne was. You know, like, he wasn't strong. He was kind of one of those old school spinners where you're just like, oh, yeah, you know, a bit like Phil Tufnell, where you're just like, he can't really field, he can't really bat, but he happens to have incredible wrists and incredible mind and can bowl, you know, very, very well. But he's not a cricket athlete in any other way. And, you know, I think his body did fall apart a little bit. But it's just an incredible thing to think that he waited all that time hoping that Warne would, not hoping, but, you know, hoping that he'd get more of a chance. And then by the time he gets a chance, his body and his mind have pretty much already checked out. And so, as you said, that he doesn't have much of a record. And it's a real shame that he didn't get his, what I would say, his Brett Lee moment. So Brett Lee doesn't retire from Test cricket that much long after McGrath and Gillespie sort of eased out of the game. But Brett Lee had that 9-month, 10-month period where he was the best bowler in the world other than Dale Steyn, right? And so, even if you look back on Brett Lee's record, you go, it's not as good as some of the other guys. We know that when he was the frontline bowler, got the new ball, everything was in his favor. He was absolutely fantastic for Australia. McGill never got that.
Yeah, no, he didn't. And are you keen to hear some fun facts about Stuart McGill that I dug up? So in his last T20 game, which he was playing for the Sydney Sixers, he took 1 for 20 in his 4 overs. And in the same game, Steve O'Keefe opened the batting for Sydney Sixers and scored a 46 ball 48. And he'll be coming on this podcast. We'll be talking about him later on. And also in ODI cricket, he had 6 wickets in 3 games at 17.5 apiece. And on debut, he took 4 for 19 versus Pakistan. So, you know, Stuart McGill definitely did his bit.
He made
in
a comeback
cricket
to T20 cricket, I think, when Brad Hogg did. But Brad Hogg was really fit, right? And Stuart McGill just looked like a guy who walked in from the street. So he tried that similar kind of thing. He just didn't have it left in him.
Yeah. And of course, Brad Hogg is the other name that comes up to mind when we think of spinners from that generation. Of course, he's a 2-time World Cup winner. Also, you know, because Shane Warne kind of retired early and then had the whole drug episode, you know. And he's someone who had a very, very good ODI career, I'd say. Averaged less than 27, took 156 wickets. Didn't have the best test career, sure. But then, you know, you just spoke about how he came back as a rejuvenated T20 cricketer, had a really, really good wrong one, and, you know, bamboozled quite a few. Played the IPL as well. Played for Australia again after having retired. And then, you know, retired just shy of his 47th birthday. So it's a really peculiar career, and he's a good mate of yours as well. So enlighten us on your thoughts about.
Yeah, Cody. I wouldn't say we're friends. I don't want to. I wouldn't go to get that far. But yeah, no, we obviously.
He also started off as a top six batter who bowled a bit of medium pace, right? It makes it weirder.
No, I mean, you know, I've chatted to him a bit recently, and you know, we've done some work together. Mm. You know, he's a really interesting guy. But yeah, he was a batter. You know, and when we say he was a batter in Western Australia when they had Gilchrist, Campbell, Goodwin, you know, Hussey, like, you know, Langer. Ridiculous. Chris Rogers.
Hodge.
Not Hodge. They would have had Martin.
Hmm.
I don't know if Voges may not have been around, but it was that era when the Western Australian team was just absolutely stacked.
Oh, right. You're talking about Western Australian.
And, right. You know, he was batting at that point. So, you know, he had some batting talent. Obviously, bold medium pace, becomes a wrist spinner. I think the thing that I thought that was quite interesting here is that if Shane Warne hadn't been such a huge figure, I wonder if they would have said to McGill, what can we do to make sure that you're ready when Warne retires? And then the same thing to Hogg of what do we do to make sure that you're ready when Warne retires? And basically what they had, they had two guys who had burnout. I mean, there's a physical aspect to what happened to McGill, but certainly mental was the major part. And with Hoggy, it was almost entirely mental. You know, we now know he played until he was 47, you know, brilliantly fit athlete from that perspective, you know, former postman and everything else. But I don't think they really thought about that. And also, he wasn't prepared to be a test bowler. You know, he wasn't a first-class bowler as much. You know, he didn't have as great a record. And I just don't think that they were really, I don't think they set themselves up to succeed. But they assumed that because they had two of them, one of them would just play for 3 or 4 years. You know, especially because they've been in Warne's shadow for so long, right? They just expected that would happen, but I don't think they really planned for it. And so Hoggy was going, you know, I think he had depression. He went through a marriage breakup. You know, there's a lot of things going on in his life. We've already talked about what happened with Stuart McGill. And so suddenly you have, as you said, a brilliant white ball wristy who just disappears. A very good Hoggy should have been the second spinner behind McGill, and they lost McGill. So we talked about them not having anyone from Benno through to Warne who was of world-class wrist spin quality. And yet suddenly they have three at the same time that all overlap that are pretty much the same age as each other, right? It's incredible to think that those things happened all at the same time and that they lost them all within 18 months. And they really never got the most out of having two great backups.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, you know, the Warne McGill and Hogg overlap. And I wonder if we'll ever see something like that from a Senna nation again in particular, right? And then, you know, this void that's created, you know, all of those guys are gone. Australia don't really have an answer. And they move on to Bo Casson. This is someone whose name you take a lot. I've been working with you for a few months and you're obsessed with Bo Casson. I've heard this name a fair few times. And this is an interesting career, right? So in that vacuum that's created, you know, in comes Bo Casson as a 25-year-old, plays a test match, takes 3 wickets, wins that test, you know, so there's that. And then he never plays a game again. And, you know, he's a left-arm wristy like Brad Hogg. He moved to the SCG like Stuart McGill. And he quit cricket at the age of 28 after 12 more first-class games after that test match, albeit due to
It wasn't just a heart condition.
But, you know,
it really wasn't. No, I mean, everything happened to him. He wasn't ready when he was picked. And he was supposed to go on that West Indies tour as a work experience kid. Stuart McGill's body falls apart. Stuart McGill goes missing. I think there were two different occasions when Cricket Australia didn't know where Stuart McGill was. One was on that tour in the West Indies. And another one, I think, was beforehand in Australia. So Stuart McGill was really, really struggling, you know, as I said before, you know, mentally he wasn't in the space he needed to be. But I think they thought he'd be fine in the West Indies. Of course, he was not, and he retired. And so Bo Casson gets thrown in, gets smashed around in that first innings. If you watch him bowl in that first innings, he did okay in the second innings, but I think they were defending 470 or something. But in the first innings, he just did not look like an international bowler. He shouldn't have been out there. They should have taken Bryce McGain, but they didn't take Bryce McGain. You know, it was before they sort of got to the sort of panic situations of someone like Nathan Horitz or something like that. And so Casson plays. but emotionally, I don't think he was ready. I talk about the heart problem, but I think there were other medical issues he had around that as well. But he just got the yips, and I think the yips were the thing that really, really caused him the biggest issue. But Cricket New South Wales just had no time for him, and realistically, he was an of all the players. I wonder if he wasn't the most international, other than maybe we'll get to O'Keefe later, but I would say of all the players, he was maybe the most international quality player that Australia had, but he wasn't ready when he was picked. He wasn't a confident person at that stage. He didn't have complete control of his best deliveries. And when he went back, he didn't get the treatment that he needed. And the heart problem is just...
Yeah.
That was the one where he probably got the treatment and he needed a little bit of extra support. Because I think Graham Manu might have played with a similar thing for Australia. I'm not sure if it was exactly the same thing. You could play with that as long as you know that you have it and everything else is there. But the truth is that it was like they just thought this was a broken guy. They thought his bowling was broken, thought his confidence was broken, and they thought with his heart, and he went down that. But I just don't think you can think that someone is a good enough player to play international cricket at 25 and allow them to walk away from the game at 28. I think there's a problem there with that system. And had they did stuff like that when Warne played. But doing it after Warne just seemed like... Bocassin might have been a great player when he was 32, right? It might have just taken him a little bit longer to come around. But sadly, we don't know.
Yeah. And like similar to Casson and to your same point, you know, you've got the Cullens, of course, Dan Cullen, the off spinner who played a solitary test for Australia, similar to Bo Casson, I guess, in that regard, versus Bangladesh. You know, I think he picked up a solitary wicket and then he played his last first class game at 25. The other Cullen, Cullen Bailey, who was a leg spinner, he got a contract, you know, after Warne retired, and he went on and played his last first class game at age 27. So this is a trend here now. And clearly, Cricket Australia was mistreating their spinners.
Yeah, I think those two, what happened was, you know, Dan Cullen was a very pretty spinner, very pretty off spinner, very similar to Tim May. And you watched him, a very, you know, sort of that traditional Australian English spinner where you, you know, drift the ball wide and spin it back in. And Cullen Bailey could bowl a leg spinner, but clearly was in development and wasn't anywhere near. He was even more in development than someone like Bo Casson was. But instead of realizing that an issue was about to come up, they did what Australia usually does, which is they just like, well, we'll just find the next great player. And so instead of going, probably working with Nathan Horitz, maybe pushing Victoria to use, you know, Bryce McGain more, Jason Crazier, all these guys that they had in the system who could bowl spin, they kind of went, no, well, we'll just find the next 22-year-old, the next 23-year-old. And if you watched Cullen Bailey, and I was, you know, lucky enough to see a little bit of him bowling, he shouldn't have had a Cricket Australia contract. It just wasn't ready to be on that level. He needed encouragement. And also the other problem was that they both played for the same team. And so they were taking a position away from each other. And I don't think either of them probably would have made it. But I don't think either of them would have gone on to be Australia's frontline spinner over a long period of time. But what happened is by pushing them so far and hyping them up and giving them these contracts, as eventually, like, they couldn't, just their normal performance was not at the level that needed to be. And so the kickback, the blowback against them was that they were both overrated. Well, yeah, you had overrated them. And then when they couldn't perform to the level that they were never going to perform to, you got rid of them, right? And in Dan Cullen's case, essentially, you read the interviews with Dan Cullen. I think Bryden's done one. Maybe Bretick might have done one as well. You can see the issue straight away. When they realized that essentially all he was a guy with a really nice drifty off spinner that spun it back, they were like, oh, you should bowl a doosra, or you should bowl faster. You should do all these different things. And his bowling fell apart by them trying to tell him to do all these different things. And in Cullen Bailey's case, Lehman was like propping him up. He was the captain. Lehman was like, I had these ridiculous fields for him. I feel like he'd have like four guys around the bat that Warne wouldn't even bowl with, right? And then like a bunch of, and he would go for runs. And so he'd take wickets, but he wouldn't have the kind of impact that you want him to, because he might take four wickets, but they might go for 120 or 140, but in like sometimes 20 overs. And especially early on in games, they just couldn't do what they were being asked to do. And then when you tried to change them, it didn't work. So the fact that you had Bocassin and the Cullens both out of professional cricket, all three of them out of professional cricket by the time they were 30. For spinners? Like, what are you doing? If you believe these guys have talent, it is your job to keep them around. And instead, they let three guys just absolutely have burnout. And it was such a misuse of talent.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely misuse their talent. And as you said, like, if you're a spin bowler, you definitely go on to play way over 30, right? Even Shane Warne played till quite a long time. But it's interesting how, you know, there's this example of Australia mistreating talent, and then there's also different examples. So I'm going to rewind the clock once again. We're going to go to one of Warne's contemporaries, the man with the funky hair. Colin Miller started off as a medium pacer and then started bowling these fast off spinners. Accounted for 69 test victims in 18 outings, which is quite a decent record. And at the turn of the millennium, he was also Australian Test Cricketer of the Year, but then discarded just as swiftly. So they're also, you know, discarding talents which have proven themselves at that level. And that is really troublesome.
I think they... So because he's a medium pacer, you know, maybe a medium fast, you know, Muhammad Abbas type speeds, I would... when I saw him play, becomes an off spinner with this weird action, well, not weird action, but weird grip on the ball because he's bowling curveballs.
Is it like Benny Howell?
Yeah, but I suppose it was more like, it's more like what you see of a part-timer. If part-timers don't usually hold the ball properly and do proper off spin, right? They usually just rip their hands around it like an off cutter. So I suppose it's a little bit like Benny Howell or Mustafizer, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, spin. He was still actually putting revs on the ball. Has this incredible success, as you say. And he was playing... So he started as a Victorian cricketer, but he came through that era where they had Dottermaid, Rifle, Merv Hughes, you know, Damien Fleming, all these really, really top... You know, Brad Williams. So many international quality bowlers. He wasn't of that level. And so he wasn't the only one. Him and David Saker both went down to Tasmania, had success with Tasmania, which weren't producing fast bowlers at the same level, right? Then he becomes this spinner. But now he's the Test Player of the Year. He's on top of the world. He was fantastic when he played, right? Nibbled a couple with the seam bowling, but mostly just as an off spinner. Just absolutely brilliant. And Australia's really happy to have him as this secondary spinner. He decides, well, I want to move back home. I've been staying in Tasmania for 10 years. Never. I'm not saying he didn't love it, but his home was Melbourne. He wanted to come back to Melbourne. Comes back to Melbourne. Sadly for him, Victoria is just off that era where they were doing really, really well, and they're about to go through a rebuilding phase, and they don't want a 35 or 36 or however old Funky was at that point spinner, right? They've got, I think they had Cameron White coming through their system. I'm trying to think if they had another finger spinner at the time that they liked as well. I think John Davison had already gone to Canada or South Australia by that point. But they just didn't think that Colin Miller was in there. That wasn't that they didn't think Colin Miller wasn't good, right? They just didn't think they needed Colin Miller in the Victorian side at that point. And so now he's not playing for Victoria. And so Australia's like, oh, well, he's not good enough to play for Victoria. We're not even going to be involved with him anymore. Why would you think that? He hasn't got any worse. He's just gone into a different situation. And so they just let him disappear.
Yeah.
And I would have thought that over that 2 or 3 year period, I think he could have kept bowling. I think his seam bowling was almost done. He was getting old. But I think he still had enough juice in his finger spin to play as the secondary spinner at that point. But remember, they had McGill as well. Right. And so they just let an international quality spinner disappear because they didn't feel like they needed him. And it's that kind of, that was always my issue with Australian cricket, is that they, instead of getting the most out of their talent, they basically said, our talent has to be tough to survive. And it was always a silly way of looking about it. This is a guy who just wanted to move home. Right. He should have had at least an extra couple of years of playing for Australia, certainly in Asia. He was a fantastic, he was probably, a better spinner in Asia than McGill was, because he was so fast through the air. And he spun the ball in a different direction than Warne and was way faster than Warne. It was a really good challenge for the batters in Asia to have those two different guys at each end. And instead, we don't need him anymore.
Yeah, I mean, he works in Vegas or runs a hotel, I think, now.
He was a croupier, so there's a great story where Warne goes into a casino to play and Funky's behind the table. And there's Warne, so he might have made it up. But yeah, I think he was a croupier and he did lots of different jobs. And now he runs a resort in Vegas, probably small to mid-level one. But, I had a look at his LinkedIn. It looks like a legitimately big thing. And he's been over there for quite some time now.
Yeah, I mean, next time any of you guys are in Vegas, definitely.
I've heard
it.
I've never met him. I've never had anything to do with him, but I've heard he's a great guy and he loves talking about his career.
Well, then if you do bump into Colin Miller, you can probably have a chat with him about his career. But anyway, now let's come to one of the most fascinating stories that was in this piece, at least for me. And you start off the story by talking about how, you as a kid in Melbourne, when you were growing up, everyone wanted to be like Shane Warne. They wanted to have the same sort of hair, same sort of action. They wanted to be Warne, which was very, very impossible to do because Shane Warne is a once-in-a-generation or once-in-a-lifetime sort of cricketer. And one of those guys was, of course, Bryce McGain, who went on to have a very odd career because he remained a club cricketer, a very average club cricketer in his 20s. Then worked in the IT sector, had a broken marriage, was fighting for the custody of his son.
I think he was split in the custody
worked
of
really,
son,
really hard.
He? But yeah, he was like, you're right. He's a really interesting dude. So he's not even from that generation that grew up under Warne, though. Because he's basically the same age as Warne. So that's what I found. So I'm right on that sort of cusp of being either way, because I was bowling leg spin beforehand. But most of my childhood was under Warne, right? Whereas McGain, he's only a couple of years younger than Warne, right? So McGain is a fully fledged leg spinner by the time he knows who Warne is, right? But it takes him 10 years to make the professional level. So he actually does end up learning a lot from Shane Warne, but not in the way a kid does. And as you said, he's an office worker. When I met him, I think he was working for the National Australia Bank, doing some IT work, and had started playing for Victoria and was having this fantastic season for Victoria, or had a fantastic season for Victoria. Yeah. But he makes his debut at 29 when I think Colin Miller was Colin Miller was back at Victoria at the time, but it was playing for Australia. I think I've got that. I think I've remembered that right. And Cameron White was there, but perhaps wasn't available, or they wanted a second spinner. He plays 5 games over 5 years.
Takes 5 wickets. I remember you mentioning like by age 35, he only had 5
is that
wickets
what it was?
In first class cricket. And this is a guy who debuted. He debuted at 29. At 35, he still has 5 first-class wickets. Then he has that season in which he's the fourth highest wicket taker.
And it's worth saying that before, so he made his debut at 29. I can't remember the exact year, but around the age of 26, he was playing second 11 cricket in club. So he wasn't even playing the first for his club team, right? So he's not even at a position where he could get picked for Victoria. And so as you said, 35-36 season for him. He essentially finds himself as Victoria's number one spinner because they just didn't have anyone. John Holland was quite young at the time. Ashton Agar had not come through yet. Michael Beer was not particularly, very well rated. So there were spinners around, right? But there just wasn't a spinner that they really believed in. And so McGain just kept getting better. And it was quite clear he was, the best spinner in club cricket at that point. They chuck him the ball and he has a fantastic year. He averages about 33, 34, but for a shield spinner, that's really good. I know those numbers, if you're used to following cricket in Asia, you'd be like, he averages 34, but those wickets, then you don't get a fifth day in shield cricket. So you don't even get the pitches falling apart. He wasn't playing on a wicket that was particularly, he's playing on a drop-in wicket at the MCG. It was really suited to medium pace bowlers nibbling it around. Was not suited to someone like him. Has this fantastic year. And then they get to the Shield final and it's basically a bowl off between him and Bocasson, who we mentioned before. Bocasson bowls really well in that game, by the way. It's probably the best I ever saw Bocasson bowl was probably in that particular game. And he made runs. I think he made 90. Bryce McGain doesn't bowl very well. In fact, he looks pretty ordinary in that game. And one of the reasons is that was his first season as a professional cricketer. And he opened a callus up on his spinning finger. And then he didn't know any better because he never had to deal with that. Was one part of being a professional he hadn't dealt with very much. He went into the ocean. The callus opened up. And so he's basically bowling with a raw wound. And we saw with Moeen Ali how that worked in the Ashes, right? It's just hard. And he misses out on that test. But then after they see Bo Casson, they realize that Bryce McGain is the better option for them. So they pick Bryce McGain to go to India. He goes over to India, plays really good against an Indian A team that was stacked. And, you know, people on the ground thought, oh, he's better than we thought he was going to be. Picks up a niggling shoulder injury. And a month later, that is really bad shoulder injury. So he gets pulled out of the Australia tour to India, where he was definitely going to make his debut. He comes back and it takes him, I reckon that was October. And I think his next first class game, I want to say, was in the middle of January or February, because then they were going to South Africa and they needed him to play one game. Plays against South Australia and he bowls dreadful in the first innings and they smash him everywhere. But South Australia have to do a really high, really fast chase on day four of that game and they attack McGain, but he gets 5 wickets. And I don't know if there was an Australian selector there and I don't know how much they were noticing, but I think they were so desperate for a spinner. Even if they were there, they were just like, look, he's taking his first game back. He's taking a 5 wicket haul. He's still the best spinner in Australia. We're going to take him to South Africa. They take it. And yeah, then, well, they take it to South Africa. He doesn't even get to South Africa, though. He misses the flight. So he's been waiting 36 years to play for his country. And he literally misses the flight where he's going to play his first test. He gets there and he plays against, it's not South Africa A, but it's like a South African A11. And they murder him. And they realize really early on what South Australia realized, which is he only has one gear. He can't bowl any faster. And he can't, if you put pressure on him, he can't do anything. That wasn't the case. I've seen him bowl before that. He wasn't like that. He was a completely different bowler with this shoulder injury. But again, remember, he never bowled this many overs before. His body is falling apart because he was, he's a club cricketer. He would play on Saturdays and Sundays. He's not used to bowling as much as he ever had before. Certainly not at that level. So Australia see him in his warm-up and go, oh, shit, well, we can't play him now. Clearly his shoulder's still an issue. So they use Marcus North as a spinner. Marcus North gets sick and ends up in hospital before the third test. They look at Nathan Horitz and they look at Bryce McGain and they're like, we probably trust Bryce McGain a little bit more. We think we want to play, we want him, they wanted him to play in the Ashes. They weren't sure about Horitz for the Ashes. They pick Bryce McGain and was it 163 off 18 overs?
It was 149 in 18 overs, which is the most expensive 15-plus over spell in Test cricket. And it's sad because, look, this is a guy who worked so hard. And at age 36, he bagged that baggy green, right? That's a big honour in Australian cricket. But he couldn't get a Test wicket. And my heart does sink for him because, you know, out of all the post-Warn spinners, they all do have that, you know, happy moment, even if it's that Bo Casson 3-wicket innings or whatever. But I think Bryce McGain could never like get that moment.
Look, I think he did. I think if you talk to him, the fact that if you're in your mid-20s and you're playing seconds club cricket, right? That's basically my level, right? You don't expect to play Test cricket. And I think he still has that moment. But I think for everyone else, whether he got a wicket or not, it was the way he was treated. Like AB de Villiers, basically, his heart broke for Bryce McGain in the Test match. He talked about it. Right, that's just not a thing that we normally see in cricket. And so, look, I still think it's a great story of someone overcoming everything. But I can understand that when you see those figures, especially, and if you see the footage, it's brutal. I'd never seen him bowl that many bad balls in his life. In the 1 year I'd seen him bowl, as he did in that game, and South Africa went after him, but the fact that he's still in public life, you know, he's hosted radio shows and he does cricket commentary and he's still around the ground, I think tells you the sort of person Bryce McGain is. The one thing I would say with Bryce McGain is going for 147, 149 runs and 18 overs in his only test and not taking a wicket and knowing that was it, did not break him, right? And that's not the case for all these guys, right? Some of them, they are defined by what happened to them. And Bryce McGain went the other way with it. He went, I wasn't supposed to be here in the first place. And you guys can laugh at me all you want, but you were the same guys who never even thought I would have made it in the first place. And I did. And so I think there's a beautiful side of the Bryce McGain story, you know, from that perspective. And I do, you know, for me, I think it is, I think it's a success, even if it was the worst debut that perhaps anyone has ever played. And I put that up with, was it Gavin Hamilton who got smashed everywhere and made a pair? I think Bryce might have had a worse debut.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you've got to credit him for his resolve, right? And is there a part of you who kind of resonates with that story, being a leg spinner yourself and not obviously having gone to that sort of length?
Yeah, I that think, McGain did? You know, I was a late bloomer in my career as well, right? You know, at what, 27, I'm parking cars for a living, right? And, you know, didn't finish high school. I didn't go through it. So even as a writer, I think there's a part of me that kind of goes, I didn't give up. If you'd asked me what I was going to be at 27, 28 while I was parking cars, I still would have said I'd be a writer, even if it would have looked ridiculous as I was, you know, parking your, you know, you with your big fancy car, Bayram. You know, if I was parking your car for you, it would have looked ridiculous, right? But that's how I felt. And I think that's what Bryce McGain was like in his 20s. And then you've got the leg spin side of things. Of, I know how hard that art is. Bryce actually taught me a lot of things about leg spin. That one thing he said to me really early on was, as a spinner in general, you basically, once the ball is out of your hand, if you've done a good job and he hits it for six, you have to actually accept that you did a good job. And I don't think that's how spinners always work, right? You know, you can bowl a great ball as a spinner and the guy just uses his feet to it beautifully and comes down, or he slug sweeps it and there's nothing that you could have done. Bryce was very good at doing that, and you realize why someone like him worked the way that he did, because all the setbacks he got, he was like, yeah, but I did that right. Right? I should have played probably earlier for Victoria, but I did everything I could to put myself in the situation to do that and they didn't pick me. Right. And so I think for me, you know, I've always said that he's the cricketer who, he was my hero as a cricketer, despite the fact that he wasn't successful. And he wasn't my hero in the way that, you know, Ian Harvey was, or Matthew Elliott was, or Wazza Makram was, or Curtly Ambrose was. But he's the hero in the fact that he was the guy that did everything he could to make it and made it. Right. And that's a very, you know, we're used to 20-year-old, we all get excited when a, you know, a 20-year-old South African batting prodigy comes through, right? But what about the guys who just, you know, do anything? In fact, I'm doing a podcast, hopefully very soon, with a guy called Tim Lindley, who now runs a coffee shop in Leeds, but he had a really good professional career as a bowler. And when I asked him to be on the podcast, he goes, why do you want me to be on it? And I said, because you didn't make it when you were young. And English cricketers, if they're not in the system by the time they're like 20, 21, they're done. They go off and get real jobs. And I said, you didn't do that.
Yeah.
You kept fighting. Bryce McGain was even further away from the system than Tim Lindley was, right? And he did everything he could to self-improve. And that's kind of what we want to do in life, right? One of the things I'm asked about most in cricket is the wobble ball. How do you pick it? What does it do? And does it exist at all? Well, one thing I can tell you is that wobble balls don't help when you're trying to groom your pubis area. For that, you want the Seam Up Precision of Manscaped. Their platinum package will ensure that your package will swing in the best way possible without the seam opening up. Their Lawnmower 4.0 will take care of anything out of shape, and then afterwards you can polish your balls with their moisturizer. Don't be dismissed by wobble balls this year. Go to manscaped.com and use the code REDINKA, all one word, to get your discount and put your balls in the best area you can.
NFL Sunday Ticket is now on YouTube and YouTube TV, which means that you can stay close to your team even if you don't live in their town. Like, maybe you're a Raven who married a Seahawk who got a job in the land of the Falcons. With NFL Sunday Ticket, you can watch your team's out-of-market Sunday afternoon games no matter where you live, because you shouldn't have to change teams, even if you change towns. NFL Sunday Ticket, now on YouTube and YouTube TV. Go to youtube.com/presale to get $50 off.
Terms and embargoes apply. Offer ends 9/19. No refund. Subscription auto-renews.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the sort of grit you need to have if you want to make your dreams work. And like you said, like, you know, he looks back at that test, as horrible a debut as that was, he's pretty happy to have bagged that baggy green. And of course, I mean, he deserves it. Anyway, moving on from Bryce McGain, and also leg spin, because now in this period, Australia have started to turn to off spin. And you've already mentioned how it's not a skill that is thought of much down under. You also, cricket's rubbish skill as per Gideon. And yet, it's, you know, very, very ironic that Australia's most successful tweaker post Shane Warne is an off spinner. Of course, Nathan Lyon has 496 wickets. He's most likely going to get to 500 wickets. And yeah, I mean, the irony really is.
And they fought him, right? Like, he comes in, he takes a wicket first ball against Kumar Sangakkara, takes that 5-wicket haul in Sri Lanka, plays well, looks threatening. You know, someone sent a message on the YouTube channel the other day saying, oh, Nathan Horrocks' record wasn't that much different. I said, yeah, but if you watched them, you understood how much better Nathan Lyon was and could be. And they didn't really feel that way. It wasn't until I saw him from side on, Nathan Lyon, that I realized why he was such a good bowler. I was covering a, I think it must have been India Australia test. And I was in the, I wasn't in the main press box. I was in the side press box. And from the side, you could just see the drop he would put on the ball. He's so hard to play. And you watch even now how few players come down the wicket, even though he's slow, how few players come down the wicket and whack him back over his head. And it's because you come down the wicket and by the time you get there, the ball has dropped and it's not quite in the position you want because of so much overspin, as we talked about before.
Yeah,
but they fought him. And, you know, the best case, the best story I've ever had and is he gets to the point where he can take a 7-wicket haul in India, you know, and a proper haul against proper players. Yeah, it was on a spinning track, but Australia didn't have anyone who could take that level of wickets. You know, the Jason Crazier taking 8 wickets, no one thought that was sustainable. Nathan Lyon, you watch him, you go, this is a sustainable, you know, haul of wickets. And they drop him for the next test, Behra. Like, and they dropped him. If you listen to Justin Langer, you go back to that whole thing. Justin Langer's basically going, oh, this Agar kid, what an athlete, right? And he talks about him as an athlete more than he does as a bowler. And there's a reason why he does that, because if you watch him bowl, he's basically a part-timer at that point, Agar. Mm. Like, he wasn't a frontline spinner. And they were so excited by the fact he could bat, he could field, he could bowl, and all this sort of other stuff, that they forgot the fact that he couldn't bowl anywhere near the level that Nathan Lyon could. But it tells you just how little. And, you know, Shane Warne was still, I think for that Ashes, I think that was the Ashes where Shane Warne was pretending he was going to make a comeback, right? Like, no one rated Nathan Lyon, and he was right there in front of you. And the thing is, as someone who lived through all these other guys, Nathan Lyon was the first person. I saw him bowl in the Big Bash. And then I think I might have seen him bowl. It was either for South Australia or it was for the A-team. And I was like, oh, shit. This is a spinner. You didn't feel that way with Crazier. Mm. Like, I'd watched Crazier for years. Even with Bryce McGain, you're like, the best you're going to get a year, year and a half out of him, right? Like, you know, that wasn't going to come through. You know, they were picking batters who could not bowl, right? And suddenly you had this guy and go, oh, no, this is a spinner. We should be doing something. And they just didn't believe in him. And a lot of it was just because he was an off spinner and he just wasn't. And if you think about it, at that time, the best off-spinner in the world was probably Swan, with Ashwin probably coming through as well. I don't know where Ashwin was in his career. No, Ashwin wasn't that. Ashwin had played it a little bit. I thought he was fantastic. He hadn't taken wickets in Australia and they dropped him. But no overseas off-spinner did at that stage took wickets in Australia. But Swan was the gold standard. And Swan was just better at everything than Lyon was. And I still think Swan was a better bowler than Lyon is now. But he played too late in his career. His elbow was already gone. All those sorts of things came in. And I think that because he wasn't as good as Swan, they again went, well, he's not even the best off-spinner around. Like, there's a better, England have got a better off-spinner. And he just kept being pushed back. But it was clear that he had the ability. And there are, I mean, it would be fair to say that Lyon is like the Stuart Broad of off-spinners, right? In that he is fantastic at the things he's really good at, but he does have a lot of weaknesses. He's not as good. He's not as good as Swan. He's not as good. He's certainly not as good as Ashwin, right? He's probably not even, he might not even be as good as Mahidi Hasan in Asia, right? But he's good everywhere and he's handy everywhere. And he's got this fantastically weird record of being one of the best first inning spin bowlers in the world because he likes the extra bounce. But it means he can bowl anywhere. Right. And he's not fantastic anywhere. And I think that was the thing that they were looking for. Right. Because they wanted, if they were going to have an off spinner, it needed to be like the Shane Warne of off spin. But it wasn't. They ended up with the Stuart Broad of off spin, which is going to end up with, I mean, Nathan Lyon could still end up with 600 wickets, right? He might even end up with 700 if he wants to continue to play. Right.
You never know.
And yet, No one's going to think he was better than Ashwin, right? I'm still saying he's not as good as Swan, right? But what he is good at, and his ability to get wickets in situations where spinners don't always get wickets, his ability to be good inside and outside of Asia is absolutely fantastic. Mm. And he's a really good bowler. And as I said, it took them a very long time to actually understand what they had and then back him.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, he's a really good team man as well. He has those team talks that we've all seen in the test. I don't know if anyone's watched that or not, but it's a bit of a thing, you know, and he has some great singing skills. And the whole story of him being part of the ground staff.
I think the year before, he played club cricket with Adam Collins, you know, and no offense to Colo, but, you know, that's a bit of a step up from like a year and a half later being Australia's spinner, right? Like, and that's how desperate they were, but that's kind of where he was, right? Like, Horrocks was picked from club cricket. And they even did it during Warne. Gavin Robertson was picked from club cricket. Like, it's very hard to be a successful cricketer in Sheffield Shield cricket, as we've already discussed. And that is a big reason. It's a bit like the old England-New Zealand batting thing, right? It's hard to be a good player if when you go back to club cricket, if you go back to first-class cricket, if you're not successful there, you're not suddenly going to feel a lot more confident when you're playing against Sachin Tendulkar.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. And it took them some time, right, before they got to Nathan Lyon. Of course, you mentioned Krejcia and Horwitz, both very weird careers, both like very differently weird careers. I'd say Krejcia, it's interesting that he had only taken 55 wickets at 49 when he made his debut in India. And that is also one of those locations or destinations where Australian off-spinners tend to debut a lot. And he takes a 12-er, you know, a 12-wicket haul in his first test. Very weird one. The most expensive 12-wicket haul ever. Yeah. Yeah, 8 in the first innings, 4 in the second, kept tossing it up, you know, giving it flight, giving it a good rip. You know, Australia had to, of course, play him again. And then he helped South Africa in chasing down 414 with 6 wickets in hand to record the second most prolific run chase in test history. So, yeah, that's a weird one, isn't it? Weird and stupid, as you said.
I followed Krejcia's career a long time. He just wasn't a frontline spinner. But again, his best ball was magnificent. And I think that's why... I think they were more sucked in by Krejcia than they were by Horwitz or Lyon, because Krejcia's best ball looked better than those guys, right?
Are you saying Jason Krejcia was a poor man's Moyne?
So it's funny, I didn't mention it in the piece, but there's a bit of that. He wasn't as smart a bowler as Moyne Ali. And he was a bit, you had to watch, I mean, if you watch him in that 12-wicket haul, that's kind of what he was. Like, you would watch him in Shield cricket. He would just be, like, attacking every ball. So I don't think Moeen Ali attacked every ball. But Moeen Ali's best ball was very similar to Krejcia's in that it would drift away, it would rag back, and you couldn't play it. But Krejcia would bowl. Krejcia would try and bowl that ball over and over again, whereas I think Moeen Ali, probably because he was more of a batter than Krejcia was, although Krejcia could bat a little bit as well. But I think because Moeen Ali was a bit of a batter, he knew enough about batters to be like, well, I can't just go try and bowl that ball 20 straight occasions because I'm only going to bowl 3 of them, all right? I'm going to bowl a few stock balls and then occasionally I'm going to bowl the best ball. Whereas Krejcia was like constantly trying to bowl that best ball and not even as good as it as Moeen Ali was. I think, you know, It was such a bizarre thing. And then they go from him to Horwitz, who's like, someone got upset because I called him the most milquetoast, but he was like, he didn't spin it. So he's the opposite of Krejcia. He wasn't an attacking spinner. He was a defensive spinner. He basically bowled in the way that a lot of those sort of Queensland finger, I didn't even talk about Dan Doran, who I think had an 8-year career as a leg spinner in Shield cricket and averaged 65. So Dan Doran and Nathan Horwitz, I think their careers would have overlapped. And, you know, Dan Doran would come in and they would basically hope that he would take 3 wickets in a chase, once every third match. And Nathan Horwitz's job was to rest the fast bowlers just by bowling darts, right? And eventually went to New South Wales as well because he had to, which is the other big thing that all these spinners end up having to go to New South Wales. So at the one time, you've got Lyon, Horwitz, Krejcia, McGill, Casson, all... as O'Keefe, all in New South Wales, because they've only got 1 wicket that spins. And then we've already talked about the fact that South Australia had the 2 Cullens at the same time. So you have all these overlaps where it doesn't really make a lot of sense. But Horwitz ends up being the opposite of Krejcia in that they just feel that he's going to dart the ball in. He's not going to spin it a lot. He was a fairly clever bowler, I think, in his own way, but he didn't do a lot with the ball in the air. And they didn't trust him. Yeah. It was the exact kind of finger spinner that Australia had always made fun of England for, right? Doesn't really spin it, keeps up an end, bats a little bit, but isn't really a batter either. But Horrocks did well. He took wickets. He improved, I thought, as an international player from the time that they picked him. They told him to fix his batting. He did fix his batting. They just didn't want him, mate. When it comes down to it, they just didn't want him. Yeah. And they eventually would pick specialist batters over him. And that was the death knell of Horrocks' career, right? Like, if you can't get into a side over Marcus North, you're eventually just not going to get picked. And so they disappeared. And that's when they went through the whole left arm finger spin thing, which Australia does trust left arm finger spin more than it does off spin.
Yeah, we'll definitely get to that. And I love how, you know, these stories are so complex and weird that on one hand, you have Bryce McGann, who worked so hard for his debut, didn't take a wicket for Australia. You got Jason Crazier almost accidentally over there in India, and he takes a 12-for on debut. Yep. So it's the contrasts are amazing. And Horrocks is also quite interesting because, you know, 5 wickets in his debut test in 2004, doesn't play again till 2008. And even though, you know, they don't back him, he's not a big turner of the ball, has confidence issues, has auctioned off his jersey at 29, but is still the third most successful spinner since Warne. So these are all like really great nuggets of information, but let's come to the left arm off spinners, right? We see Australia going, you know, double trouble, adding Xavier Doherty and Michael Beard, just particularly to counter KP, because KP struggled big time versus left arm off spin. They didn't go with Steve O'Keefe, who had a great record and ended up with 301 test, or no, not test wickets, first class wickets at 29 apiece. And he also took a 12-for in India in a test match that Australia won, a very memorable one, right? So, I mean, of course, you can blame him, alcohol and foul mouth that ultimately also cost
last
him
a couple of years of his career.
But
yeah,
then you got other... Yeah, definitely. You got other players who have that profile. You mentioned Ashton Agar, of how Justin Langer was said that he's a great athlete. Well, he got that memorable 90-something on debut, but that's what we remember Ashton Agar, the test cricketer, for, not his bowling. And he probably never was going to cut it with ball in hand, even though he's, you know, somewhat made it work in limited overs cricket. But yeah, but this whole obsession with left-arm off-spinners and then also not giving Steve O'Keefe his due recognition and games, because he ultimately ended with 9 test matches. What's your take on this entire period?
So they wanted a tall left arm finger spinner. And I didn't go into that specifically in the piece, but that Australia basically, you know, wanted someone who was tall and left arm finger spinner who could drop the ball on a leg, sort of Monty Panesar, Ashley Giles, John Inverarity style of left arm finger spinner, Paul Harris, right? Because they thought that was, they could control one end and then they could attack with the paces at the other end. They weren't expecting a lot of wickets, but they didn't really have that player. Like, Agar wasn't good enough, right? His bowling wasn't good enough. It still isn't good enough in red ball cricket. They tried Michael Beer over a couple of different occasions. Michael Beer, again, fantastic white ball cricketer. Just didn't have what he needed, in red ball cricket to be a constant threat. And they told
John Holland.
So I don't know what John Holland's height is. John Holland, I think, just got in again through weight of wickets at a certain period. But Steve O'Keefe is short. I don't know if I can do that live. But you know, I've stood next to him. He's not a particularly tall player, and so he was told, at 5'9", right? So I would have thought John Holland is probably around 6 foot. Michael Beer's probably 6'4". Agar's probably 6'2", 6'3", but really long limbed if you look at Agar. And they told O'Keefe to his face, O'Keefe asked them, what do I need to do to play for Australia? And the selector said, grow a foot and bowl a doosra. Like, that just shows how idiotic Australian cricket was at that point. Like, what the, who says that to someone? What sort of a fucking idiot says that to someone? And you're picking the team? And obviously, he wasn't going to be able to grow a foot. Also, left-arm finger spinners, I think they should bowl doosras and carom balls, but they don't traditionally bowl them. And he just kept getting overlooked. And yet, you know, and even when he takes that 12 wicket haul, it's actually great. If you go back and listen to the full commentary, that Shane Warne, the entire time through commentary, is basically going, oh, I wouldn't have picked O'Keefe. O'Keefe's no good. They shouldn't have picked O'Keefe. As he's taking all the wickets this winning the test match. And
well, Warne, he was also against Lyon.
Warne had his spinners. I mean, he certainly backed McGain. So he certainly had his spinners. Mm. But the point being that even when he took wickets, people didn't really back him. And I would say in my career, he's one of the cricketers I was asked the most about. You know, you got Fawad Alam is another one, you know, and Steve O'Keefe, and Sarfraz is probably becoming another one in modern times, where people are just like, how are you not trying these guys? And it's a fair question, right?
Yeah.
What's his name? Hildreth from Somerset was another one. And sometimes there's real reasons. Fawad Alam and Hildreth, I think, played a part in it. And O'Keefe probably played a bit of a part in it as well. He was injured so often that even his best years, he would end up with 25 to 40 wickets. Whereas actually, he probably could have taken, you know, 50 to 55 in some of those years had he been fully fit. And he would take 15 wickets at like an average of 22. And it's like, well, did he just play on a good wicket? We don't know. But he was seen as a white ball specialist, despite the fact he was really good at red ball cricket all the way through. So I just think they were looking for a different kind of left arm finger spinner than he was. He certainly should have played a lot more. He would have been a really good counter to Nathan Lyon on a lot of those Asian tours. And he could bat a bit. He wasn't a batter. I think you said before he opened the batting in a T20 game. That was a bit of a stretch for him.
Yeah.
But as a number eight who was tough to get past, you know, he had a bit of Ashley Giles type, you know, Paul Harris skill to him. And, you know, there was something to him as a cricketer. A very good mover in the fielder as well. He just, they weren't thinking about things in the right way. Right, they weren't in the right headspace, which is how do we maximize the spin talent that we had? They were still on this thing of how do we find another great spinner, and that's fine if you have another great spinner coming through, right? But even with Lyon and O'Keefe, they were both mistreated because they weren't great, but they were both really, really good. And in O'Keefe's case, you just never used him correctly, and you can already see how much smarter they are with Todd Murphy. They're already saying and Kuhneman. Yeah. Right? They're already behind the scenes going, great. Well, Kuhneman is, every time we go to Asia, we'll make sure that he's ready to go and he's there. Todd Murphy will be the backup spinner and also the second spinner when we need him, but he'll be groomed as the main spinner going ahead. They're just thinking about things so much more clear. Whereas I mean, if you go back, they used five left arm finger spinners in, was it 2 years or a year and a half, right? Where they were just panicking. That's not even mentioning the batters, you know, Smith, North and White all playing. Crazier and Horrocks playing, McGain playing.
You've got Simon Gadditch, you're trying to make Michael Clark. Lots of those guys were bold spinners going,
and they tried to make him a frontline spinner in Asia. The whole thing was just falling apart. Yeah. And Michael Clark basically couldn't bowl because of his bat. Simon Gadditch didn't want to bowl, right? And Cameron White was a captain who didn't bowl himself. And they were the three spinners on an Indian tour. It was baffling what they were doing.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at it now, there's a lot more sense in what they're doing. Doesn't mean they're going to be massively more successful because sometimes you get the right bowlers and sometimes you don't. But compared to what was going on between 2008 and 2013, it was fucking chaos.
Yeah. Maybe, you know, in the case of Cameron White and perhaps even Michael Clark, it's just because they look like blonde hair.
You make that joke, man. Cameron White is a big part of the reason, you know, him being a big, broad-shouldered Victorian with blonde hair did actually play a part in the hype around Cameron White. And he did have a good couple of early years. But, like, I watched a lot of Victorian cricket in those days. He wasn't a leg spinner. Like, he was a clever part-timer, right, at his best. And that's all he was ever going to be. And quite clearly, he didn't think he was a leg spinner. He had that same thing that happens to a lot of spinners. And I think when he had a growth spurt, he kind of changed what kind of a bowler he was. And he wasn't as good afterwards as he was before. I mean, I don't know if you've ever stood near Cameron White. Cameron White is massive. He's about 6'4", 6'5", but he's solid. Like, he's like just a huge dude. Leg spinners don't look like that. It was such a weird, he looked like he, you know, should have been playing rugby union, not bowling leg spin. And he was big compared to Warne, and Warne was massive for a spinner.
True. I mean, there are lots of those guys, right, who were primarily batters but used as spinners. You've got your Cameron Whites. Of course, we mentioned
Mike Clark, Simon
Gattage.
I could have done Marcus Bevan as well.
Yeah, yeah, you can mention Bevan. Marcus North has a
fifer
at Lords versus Pakistan. He's got his name, he's got his name on the honors board. So there's that. And then, you know, two of the other guys, Steve Smith and Manus Labuschagne, brought in as spin, you know, options, and are now two of Australia's best batters in contemporary cricket. So do you see more of the same trend continuing to the future, or are you pinning your hopes on, you know, Murphy in a post Lyon?
I've said before, I think Murphy's the most talented spinner I've seen from Australia since Lyon. And I like Kuhneman as a Asian specialist spinner in the way that Steve O'Keefe probably should have been used. Those two options coming through should mean that at least Australia has. I mean, I think we know with Murphy that he's not overawed. He's a very sensible cricketer. He can bat a little bit. Like he's, you know what I mean? You know, there's something about him as a cricketer, I think, overall. He's not a finished article though yet, in the same way that Lyon wasn't when he began either. You know, Lyon's first few years, he did struggle a little bit. If Todd Murphy is at the ability he's at now and he can continue to be used and they can use Kuhneman as a specialist, they've still got Mitch Swepson around. You know, there are some young other spinners coming through as well. That I think they're in a much better situation. They're in a much better situation because they don't expect Todd Murphy to be a great bowler. They don't. There's no savior. Todd Murphy is not seen as a savior, right? He's just another person who's coming into the team. They know exactly the kind of role they want. They know the exact way they want to develop him, and they're hoping that works. It may not work, right? And with Kuhneman as well, what do you do with Kuhneman? You make sure that he's ready to bowl in Asia, whatever you want. But the other thing with Kuhneman is, who can he work with to make sure that he's a better spinner away from Asia in case you need him? Because eventually he'll be Murphy's backup, right? Those are the sorts of things that they are thinking about now. And before, if you go back to the 2008-2013 period, it was just anarchy, mate, right? It was a complete panic.
Yeah.
And I think they're much better now at the way that they develop talent and the way that they look after people. So I don't expect another situation. But the problem is, and you can go to Warne, but you can also go to Botham with this. I'm trying to think of other players who've had that kind of impact of you are, when they are of that size, you just think to yourself, there's two options. You either go the Garfield, Sobers, Bradman sort of side. Oh, actually, Bradman's not a good example, but Sobers is a good example of, we're not going to find another all-rounder like Sobers. How the hell did we find one, right? Or you go the other way of going, oh, maybe there's a next guy. And maybe there's a next guy. That is always the wrong way of doing it. What you should be doing is, any one stage, is looking at how your talent pool is, right? And trying to make the best usage of that. And if you look at what Australia did, they didn't. They panicked. They went over the top. They did everything wrong. Right, in that situation that they should not have done. And because of that, I think they ruined careers of good prospects. They also just made themselves look like idiots. They didn't get the most out of players like Colin Miller and probably even, you know, some of the other guys that came afterwards. They didn't get the most out of the ones that were very good. And I think Australia is very similar to Pakistan. They are always looking for the next great. But they quite often overlook the very good player right now. And I think Australian cricket, when it was at its best, actually had the ability to go, we'll give this Mike Hussey kid a go. By kid, I mean 30-year-old a go, right? We'll give Chris Rogers a go, right? Because these are really good players. And I think that if you keep chucking the ball to 20 and 21-year-olds, the history of Australian and Pakistan cricket, we overlook all those broken careers, right? And you need a combination of both. You're not going to find a Shane Warne, if you wait until he's 28, it's too late. But Shane Warne was ready emotionally and was ready physically, right? He just needed the skills to match that, and he learned them very quickly when he started. But if he hadn't, you don't want to throw him back away. You want to keep working with him. And I think Australian cricket is now in a position where they do that. And I think the position that they were in before was untenable, and they were just lucky that they kept getting so much talent. They're not in that position quite at the moment. And so now they have to be smarter.
You could say that just in the way that Shane Warne's shadow was detrimental to all of these people, Nathan Lyon's shadow will actually be beneficial to people like Todd Murphy. And it's interesting, you know, because Todd Murphy could go on to have a much better career than Steve O'Keefe, whereas at a point where Steve O'Keefe's numbers were really good in Shield cricket, you could have argued that he should have played more for Australia.
The Nathan Lyon one's perfect because you're right. It could be beneficial. But also, if Todd Murphy gets better than Nathan Lyon, he'll just come into the team. You couldn't be better than Shane Warne.
Absolutely.
So even when you were ready to take that role was never going to be around for you, right? So Nathan Lyon is good, but not great. He's an Australian great, but he's not an all-time great. Mm. He can be dropped and might be dropped towards the end of his career. If he starts to get to the last couple of years, he's averaging 34 and 35, they're going to look at Todd Murphy and they go, we think he can average roughly the same. We'd rather give him a run in the team averaging 34 or 35 because we can have him for another 8 years after that, whereas Nathan Lyon's only got a couple left.
Mm.
It's a completely different world, right? And it's, you know, it's much easier to replace Ian Bell, right, than it is... I'm trying to think. Then Kane Williamson, right? The difference between those two things is at the end of Ian Bell's career, you could drop him a little bit too early. A couple of people would be annoyed, right? But you can move on. You can't move on from Kane Williamson. You can't. You know, there are certain players it is impossible to move on from because of your cricket culture. And Warne was one of those. And, you know, and Nathan Lyon just isn't one of those. And so, again, Australia's in a better position.
Yeah, and it's interesting how, you know, during Warne's time, you spoke of this guy who was bowling fast leggies. His name was Craig Howard. And it's a good place to end this podcast as well, because whilst Warne had that massive shadow, this is a guy who made a comeback into cricket as an off spinner after being, you know, a leg spinner prior. Never played for Australia, went through the Australian Academy twice for two different disciplines, played his last first class game age 21, and then went on to be pivotal with respect to providing Australia with a new generation of spinners by working with Nathan Lyon and spotting Todd Murphy. So in a way, Craig Howard, whilst being in Shane Warne's shadow, still had an impact on the game. And that's just what makes all of this really beautiful, isn't it?
You know, the Craig Howard story is incredible. You know, he was the freakish young leg spinner. If you watch him bowl, he wasn't anything like Warne, but he was almost as captivating as Warne. And you look at the players that he dismissed and you're like, these are not, he doesn't have a good bowling average, but you look at the players he dismissed in first class cricket and you're like, oh my God, like this guy has a ridiculous record of the players that he's got out. And he wasn't treated well. Cricket Victoria wasn't very professional at the time. Mm. They were dicks to him. His body was falling apart.
Mm.
He went through the early biomechanics and Australia just thought his biomechanics didn't work. So instead of remodeling him or fixing it, they let him go. He was so good and talented that he came. I mean, imagine being good enough to be a professional wrist spinner and then coming back as a professional off spinner, right? That's how clever and talented he was.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Lovely guy to deal with, but played his last first class game at 21. I mean, we talk about Cullen Bailey and Bo Casson and Dan Cullen. They got to their mid-20s, right? He didn't even get that far.
Yeah.
And I don't think any of them were as talented as Craig Howard was. And then you have this thing of he accidentally becomes Nathan Lyon's mentor because it's Darren Berry obviously has the big role in discovering Nathan Lyon off the ground staff, as you said. And he just turns to the spinner he grew up with, Craig Howard, to come in. And they form a special bond. And John Davison was another spinner. Who, I didn't mention John Davison in this because he's fascinating too. Never played for...
He's Canadian.
He's from my Canada. But remember, he set the record for the fastest ever 100 in a World Cup. Another Australian spinner who played for Victoria during Shane Warne's era, by the way.
Interesting.
There's so many weird sub-stories we could do from this. But the point is, John Davison helped Lyon a little bit, but I think his main mentor has always been Howard. And then Craig Howard is that regional Victorian guy. You know, he lived in Bendigo and... Because of that, he saw cricketers from outside of the mainstream of Melbourne and Sydney. And one of them he saw was Todd Murphy. All right. So he ends up mentoring the spinner who's taken 500 or almost 500 wickets and perhaps the one who will replace him. And I talked to Craig Howard 2008, 2009. I tracked him down. Weirdly enough, I used to work with his wife's best friend. And I had said, she said, her friend's husband used to play cricket for Victoria. And I sort of said casually, oh, who's that? She said, Craig Howard. And I went, Craig Howard, the leg spin. And she didn't even know what I was talking about. And she went, and I said, like a tall, thin. And she's like, yeah, that's him. And I was like, and I'd been looking for him for years. I didn't know what had happened to him. There's two Victorian cricketers that had gone missing and he was one of them. And I talked to him, and I think he was working for Telstra at the time, the telephone company in Australia. And he probably thought he was going to have like a 15-minute interview. And we must have been on the phone for about an hour and a half. And he was in tears by the end, mate, because he hadn't really talked about his career.
Damn.
And when I first started writing about all these guys, I wrote about them as this box of broken toys, right? Of, you know, isn't it funny, you know, Jason Crazier got done for cocaine abuse and then he had a career that looked like he'd sniffed cocaine for, right? And, you know, Brad Hogg and all that sort of stuff. But when Craig Howard came back and becomes the mentor for those two guys, I started to realize that, like, this was just a special group of people who were just wrong place at wrong time and that they all did incredible things and were mistreated. And they weren't just broken toys. They were fully functioning people who happen to come into the shadow of, you know, there's only so much oxygen in the world at any one time. And Shane Warne took a lot more oxygen up than you or I or those guys ever would, right? Yeah. And when Craig Howard had that comeback, and also Nathan, don't forget, Nathan Lyon gets good in that point as well, right? You suddenly I started to look at their whole stories in a different way. So I think if I'd written the book in 10 and 11, it would have been a bit more of a comedy of errors type thing. And so now I look at it of these incredible life stories of all these. I mean, we didn't talk about Michael Beer, right? You know, the guy who got picked to play in Western Australia, despite the fact he'd never really played at the Wacker before. You know, all these incredible stories of all these different people and how they were successful in life and how they were successful under the shadow of one of the greatest to ever do it. And as you said before, we might never see a period where a Western country has that many great spinners at the one time as Australia did. And we might never see another Western country have a spinner as good as Shane Warne again, right? And these guys happen to be a wrong place, wrong time. But we're talking about their hero. There's a podcast I did with Bryce McGain where we talk about how great Bryce McGain, how great Shane Warne was. Shane Warne didn't look at it as if, Bryce McGain didn't look at it as if Shane Warne ruined his life, right? He was his mentor by the end of it. And a lot of these guys looked up to him. Nathan Lyon has a more of a complicated relationship with Shane Warne, or had one. But they loved him. But because he existed, their lives were different. And in some cases, better. Cullen Bailey probably doesn't get an Australian contact if it wasn't for Shane Warne, right? But Colin Miller wouldn't have been flicked away if it wasn't for Shane Warne, right? And so it's this incredible you know, the greatest who ever did it has this incredibly complicated relationship with all these different human beings. And I think on top of all of this, it's something I've always been fascinated with is pace bowlers in Asia and spin bowlers in South Africa and Australia. How do you do the thing that you're not supposed to do when everything is against you? And we see it again and again. And I just find it a fascinating way of looking at the life stories of what I think is one of the most eclectic and interesting group of people that I've ever written about.
Yeah. And I mean, now that we've recorded this marathon podcast on this, I think it would make for a great book. And you spoke of them as, you know, us looking at them as like broken toys. I think they were all very unique toys, but they were just victims of the shiny new toy syndrome, you know, and that was probably that cost them their career. So if anyone over there, right by Jared, is listening at the Oval, you know, get Steve O'Keefe in there because I'd love to watch him and Kemar Roach play in the same team. If you got that joke, you got that joke. On that note, I will end this podcast. Thank you so much for your time, Jared, and for everyone who listened in. We'll catch you once again next week for another episode of Footmarks. That's all for now. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are many other extras as well, including a Discord channel. There's a link to those in the show notes. Please review, subscribe, and tell all your friends about our show. Word of mouth is the best way of making our podcast grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bharat Sundaresan and Bayram Kazi. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston. Each episode is produced by Ishit Kuberka at Sound Potion Studio. The team from 42 help us out with the video side. Orajoti Senapayu and Maida Akam, both producing podcasts, while Mukunda Bandredi is the head of our YouTube content.
Sports Social Podcast Network.